Welcome to the comeback edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Comeback Elving.
And I have no comeback for that. And I'm Ken Reardon. But Ron, I speak
of... Will the podcast ever come back?
Well, we do have redemption.
We have redemption.
Yes.
Will the podcast ever be redeemed?
Well, hopefully the listener will agree. But there's a lot of news on the redemption front.
This is the big week for comebacks.
Yes, it is.
And I would say the first story that really came back this week is not that one down in South Carolina that I know you're eager to talk about, but the one about Benghazi.
Well, that has come back to the delight of Republicans, and I will say that this could very well hurt Obama's chances of getting reelected in 2016, which is, you know, a constitutional matter as well. But the thing is, are the Republicans willing and eager to use this against Obama and, of course, Hillary Clinton for 2016? Of course. Are Fox News and all those conservative outlets very eager to keep this in the public domain? Of course. Are there real questions that have not been answered that were raised at the House hearings this week? I say yes. I say Gregory Hicks, the 22-year Foreign Service officer, is not an ideologue. I don't think he has a political bone to pick, but he does have questions about what was done in the aftermath of the mounting tension at Benghazi.
All right. Are we talking strictly now about what happened after the incident, or are we talking about the incident itself?
I think we are talking about both, because there seemed to be some indication that we are in trouble, we need some help, and there's some questions whether the Obama administration could have done something quicker.
What kind of a time frame are we talking about here?
Well, there are two things what we're talking about. The Republicans seem transfixed on the fact that Susan Rice had different answers at different times.
Okay, that's on a bunch of talk shows
and
a week
later. That's insane.
That has nothing to do with the people who died.
There are some people who clearly want to play politics with this. There are certainly Republicans who would be very happy to not only embarrass the Obama administration, but of course help cripple Hillary Clinton's aspirations for 2016. At the same time, Gregory Hicks was not, the way I saw it, not playing politics, not trying to become a Fox News commentator, but somebody basically who was recounting what happened during those terrible hours and terrible days.
Secretary of State Clinton called me, along with her senior staff. We're all on the phone. And she asked me what was going on, and I briefed her on the developments. Most of the conversation was about the search for Ambassador Stevens. It was also about what we were going to do with our personnel in Benghazi. And I told her that we would need to evacuate. And that was the right, she said that was the right thing to do. At about 3 a.m., I received a call from the Prime Minister of Libya. I think it's the saddest phone call I've ever had in my life. He told me that Ambassador Stevens had passed away.
There have been a number of investigations already. None of them is flattering to the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. None of them makes the administration look as though it responded well to this particular emergency.
And let's not forget that it came 6 weeks before the election, and there seemed to be some electoral considerations in not the response on the ground.
Not in terms of saving these people.
Absolutely
who were
not
killed,
no, of course
which
not.
Is, you know, nonetheless what puts all the emotion behind this story. What puts all the emotion behind it is this endless repetition of the videotape of the fires at the consulate and the sense that these people died in this attack. Of course, Hillary Clinton is the key figure. As you said earlier, Obama can't run again in 2016, but in a sense, that election in 2016 will be a referendum on his administration, and certainly insofar as it pertains to Hillary Clinton's performance in that administration, it'll very much be a referendum.
And so the fact is that with people like David Bossie getting involved in this, with Daryl Issa leading the charge, with, of course, conservative talk radio also jumping on this story, it does justify the Democrats' argument that a lot of this is political. But then again, when you hear Gregory Hicks, who's not a member of the John Birch Society, he's not a card-carrying member of Fox News, he's somebody who just happened to be the deputy chief of the mission in Benghazi
at
the
time. And, of course, felt the tragedy in keen personal terms.
Of course, in fairness, so did everybody, including the administration. But the thing is, you can't play this politically. Both the Republicans can look at this with glee. Democrats could say this is the vast right-wing conspiracy, politics as usual. But there's a third way of looking at it, saying that there are unanswered questions, or at least heretofore unanswered questions that the administration still has to own up to.
What are the questions? What are the questions they need to answer?
The questions, of course, are what the administration did in the aftermath, what they were saying they were doing in the aftermath, what could they have done in the aftermath, given the fact that Hicks and Company were crying out for what they were crying out
for. But this was all dealt with in all the previous investigations, and these were exactly the questions that were asked then, and the answers to them are not flattering to the State Department in the least, and the answers to them are not flattering with respect to the White House. They did not cover themselves with glory, and they did look for some kind of a political cover, a muffler, if you will, around the story. All of that was pretty well established last fall. So the question is, why did this all come back?
Well, it came back clearly because the Republicans are anxious not to let this go. There's no question about that. But at the same time, hearing Hicks and reading a report are two different things. And of course, you'll have that tape from now until Iowa, New Hampshire, 2016, and into the fall. So, Ron, now we've established that Benghazi has come back, and now we have another person coming back, Mark Sanford.
Mark Sanford. Wasn't he governor down in South Carolina? How often does a governor in American history leave office and then come back as a congressman?
You're not talking about Bill Janklow of South Dakota.
I knew you were going to bring up Bill Janklow.
Well, some other time.
And where is Bill now?
He's dead.
But before he was dead, he
killed
was
somebody else.
In prison.
He didn't kill somebody in prison.
No,
he went
no.
to prison.
That's
because,
right.
Because
he had killed somebody.
With his motorcycle.
Anyway, Mark Sanford, the
yes.
former governor,
yep.
the man who took the trip down the Appalachian Trail, which we have talked about in countless podcasts over the years and even used as our theme music week after week, actually got reelected. Well, reelected in the sense that he is now back in the congressional seat that he was in before he was governor of South Carolina.
Look, I think it's amazing news about Mark Sanford. I think the irony is that he's going to be on the Foreign Affairs Committee.
No.
but more importantly, but here's the real thing. Aside from that very, very clever joke, the more important thing is that, yes, this was a Republican district. Yes, Mitt Romney won it by 18 points. But 2 weeks ago, we were all convinced that Sanford was going to lose and lose big.
There was a reason that people thought so, because he seemed to be abandoned by the Republican establishment.
Because?
The National Republican Congressional Committee abandoned him. He didn't seem to have
because
the kind of backing
because
that he
of the trespass,
would have had.
Right, because of the trespassing on his ex-wife's
That's
home.
That's right. And everybody thought he was dead.
And don't forget, as the NRCC was staying out of the race, pro-Democratic groups were giving over $1 million, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but in that district it was a lot of money, considering the fact it was much more than Sanford was spending.
Yes, but all of that money, in a real sense, was meaningless, because this was never a race about Elizabeth Colbert
right,
Bush.
Agree.
It was always about Mark Sanford,
right.
And it was always a question of how many Republicans would choose to stay home in order to let him lose so that they could then replace the Democrat, who was very temporary, in November of 2014 with another Republican they liked better than Mark Sanford. And that was the accepted wisdom, that many Republicans were going to do that. But in the last 2 weeks, you suddenly see all of these South Carolina politicians, all these South Carolina Republicans saying,
Nikki
no,
Haley,
we don't
Scott,
want to take right. a loss. We don't want to see a Democrat even for 5 minutes in this seat. We're going to rally behind Mark Sanford, and we're going to do it about the issue of Obamacare, and we're going to do it about the idea of Nancy Pelosi
right?
suddenly being happy for 5 minutes because Elizabeth Colbert Bush was in this seat. And so even though in the long run we don't really like the idea of having Mark Sanford represent us, we'd rather have that than even 5 minutes of a Democratic placeholder.
That's very good analysis now that we know that Mark Sanford won it. But we've seen, first of all, South Carolina won is solid Republican territory. It hasn't voted for a Democrat since 1978 in that district for Congress. There is clearly Republican leaning, shall we say, in South Carolina 01. We have seen in other districts where scandal was involved and the voters decided to punish the Republican Party in power, whether it was the candidate running or not, either he stepped down or was running again, they would punish the Republicans because they felt that this behavior is unacceptable and we're going to teach the party a lesson. Ultimately, though, Mark Sanford was a much better candidate. He was everywhere. He was omnipresent, campaigning everywhere. Elizabeth Colbert Bush had nothing to say. I mean, nobody was paying attention to her. But again, it goes back to our theme from the beginning. This was always a referendum on Mark Sanford.
Or look at Anthony Weiner's district after he had humiliated himself online. That district also elected a Republican and they had a special election. Right. I mean, I think you're right that it is typical that the party where there's been a humiliation of the incumbent often pays the price, even if the incumbent leaves the
scene. Like Chris Lee in upstate New York, for
example. There you go. Yeah. And I think that is more the pattern. But in this case, what we've seen is a candidate who actually sees his return, his comeback, as, you know, something of divine intervention.
I think that, you know, the number of people who've brought up with me this larger notion of God's grace have been angels. I think the number of people who've come up to me and said, you know, Mark, it's life, a good part of life is about getting back up. Not how you stumble, not how you fall, not how you handle situations, but how you get back up in the wake of those situations. And I just want to acknowledge a God, not just of second chances, but third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth chances, because that is the reality of our shared humanity.
You know, Ron, he makes a good point. I mean, this podcast has had more chances, and we've also had third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh chances.
350, roughly.
Right, and still nobody's listening to us.
All right, but you know who I don't think has a second chance at big-time politics is Anthony Weiner. We talked about him a moment ago. He's now talking about running for mayor after all. What do you think, Ken? You know a little bit about New York.
I don't think he runs for mayor. I think he certainly wants to run for mayor. One would think that voters in New York might be more forgiving of those kind of lapses than social conservatives in South Carolina.
One might think.
But in the September primary, September 10th primary in New York, you have at least four or five citywide elected officials. We have the city controller. We have the public advocate. We have the speaker of the city council, Christine Quinn, who's considered the front runner. We have the former controller, who ran against Michael Bloomberg.
Acceptable choices. All these are acceptable Democrats. None of them may be knocking everybody's socks off.
No, they're not. No, that's exactly right. And actually, the one thing with Anthony Weiner, he didn't knock his socks off. But that was the only
Anthony would have been better off if he had only taken his socks off.
That's right. And then his last name would be Socks instead of Weiner.
I
mean, I could say that.
I get it. Okay. All right.
Well, what about Soxby Chambliss?
Yeah, well, he had a hole in one just this week, playing golf with the president.
That putts.
Maybe that. It just shows it was part of the president's drive to get along better with Republicans.
Par for the course. Okay, so now that we finally dismissed with South Carolina won, we still have another special election coming up June 25th that may or may not be competitive. This, of course, is a special election to succeed the very popular Mo Cowan.
No, Mo Cowan was the placeholder
after
John Kerry was appointed Secretary of State.
So how did Mo Cowan become senator?
He was appointed by the governor, Deval Patrick.
Oh, okay.
This is Massachusetts, Ken. Follow along here. This is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Well, in the June 25th special election to succeed John Kerry / Mo Cowan, you do have two candidates, Ed Markey, 66 years old, in Congress since 1977, been around a long time, and a new face, Gabriel Gomez, the former Navy SEAL.
Also has a Harvard MBA.
He does, and I didn't know he played basketball.
He's a very good-looking guy. He's got a great-looking family. He's got a wonderful resume. And to some people's minds, he might have some of the same mojo that Scott Brown had a few years ago when he won the seat that had been Teddy Kennedy's.
Right. The difference, of course, is that back then, the numbers about Democrats and President Obama and Obamacare were not that good, even in Massachusetts.
And Martha Coakley.
And Martha Coakley was not a good candidate. But there are two new polls out the last couple of weeks. First of all, a week or so ago, the Democrats got very nervous about this public policy polling number that had Ed Markey up only 44-40 over Gomez, and as a matter of fact, had Gomez leading among independents 47-31.
But this is not that shocking, because this is where Scott Brown won among independents. There's much made of the ratio of Democrats to Republicans in Massachusetts being terribly lopsided, but neither of those parties is a majority party. The Democrats are the plurality party, but independents are very well represented in Massachusetts.
And Gomez is not somebody who's identified with the Republican brand. But anyway, there's a new poll, Suffolk University poll that just came out, had Art Markey up 17 points, 52-38. I still kind of think...
In the middle.
Yeah, but I think it's probably more the bigger spread than the close. look, there are a lot of people say don't rule out Gomez. Stranger things have happened, and that's true. We still have until June 25th of the election. I think Markey wins, and I don't think it'll be that close.
I would expect that to be the case, but there's still that possibility that Gomez could find that special spot that does exist in Massachusetts and that has elected Republicans statewide, especially if something should happen on the national scene that creates that kind of energy you were referring to from 2010 when we saw Scott Brown riding the concern about the new health care law and the sort of pushback against the Obama administration. We could see a return of that kind of sentiment, and if so, then Ed Markey's got big problems.
Perhaps. But one election that does not look close at all, and I think everybody agrees with this, is in New Jersey. Governor Chris Christie, a new NBC Marist poll, has him up 60 to 28 over Barbara Buono, a state senator. Look, maybe this is all Hurricane Sandy. Maybe it's just about Chris Christie, who is just omnipresent, but that doesn't look like a competitive race at all.
It doesn't, but I don't think that his margin in that particular race is going to get any bigger. And
no.
The reason I think so is because he's got this silicone band around it, and it doesn't allow it to get any bigger.
Right. And, of course, this is a code for the lap band surgery that, of course, he lost a lot of weight.
Now,
of
40 course, pounds.
Of course, the political push on this has always been, well, he's going to lose weight because he's running in 2016. But there are other justifications for losing a lot of weight, clearly.
Absolutely. I understand it's good for your health.
And his, too.
And so I could see why he might want to. I mean, look, I mean, he's got a family. He's got his own health to think about. You know, and did you see him do the Letterman show where he said, I'm the healthiest fat man you're ever going to see? And Letterman said, well, that's your campaign slogan right there. It needs to be done for all the above reasons, and not least of which, if he wants to be taken seriously as a presidential candidate in 2016, and I believe he does.
But he will insist, at least as of now, he'll say that this is not a totally political decision.
My decisions about anything to do with my career are based upon what I think is best for me and best for my family. And, you know, whatever size I happen to be when I have to make decisions about what to do next with my career, I doubt that'll play any role or effect in what I decide to do. I mean, I think I made that pretty clear to you guys over time. It's not a career issue for me.
Okay, well, I hope you guys got that right.
If it's a runaway New Jersey, it's certainly very, very close in Virginia.
Yeah, in fact, the polls are kind of confusing on this a little bit because the Washington Post had a poll that showed Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general in the state
Republican.
There. Republican, very conservative, pretty much conceded the nomination, really, by the Republican Party there in Virginia, is leading Terry McAuliffe, the only Democrat making a serious bid here for that governorship, and leading him by 10 points among likely voters.
Right. 5 points among all voters, 10 points among likely voters, right.
And now we have an NBC Marist College poll that says that McAuliffe is actually ahead among all voters.
43-41.
But Cuccinelli still with a lead among likely voters.
With 3 points, exactly. So it's very, very close. What's interesting is that, first of all, both are flawed candidates. Cuccinelli may be too conservative for many Republicans in the state, not all Republicans.
Well, certainly women Republicans because of some of the issues that he was involved with in his 4 years as attorney general.
And Terry McAuliffe, the former DNC chair, the Clinton chum, is not beloved, shall we say. He did run for governor 4 years ago, lost the Democratic primary. Neither one has 100% backing by everybody in the party. But right now, Cuccinelli, in these numbers, looks stronger than I would have expected. Okay, so those are the people who are running in 2013. This week, we got a whole list of people who are not going to run for the Senate in 2014.
Again, we observe that the Senate is not the lure it once was. More and more people who you would think would be absolutely seeing their greatest opportunity to make it from the House into the United States Senate are stepping back and saying, maybe that's not what I want. Steve King in Iowa, Republican, very conservative, closely identified last year with Michelle Bachmann's campaign for president. This is somebody most people thought would be formidable in the Iowa Republican Party primary for the Senate. This, of course, for the seat of Tom Harkin, the Democrat who's retiring after many terms. This week, Steve King said, no, I'm not going to run.
And another congressman, a Democrat in Georgia, John Barrow, a longtime Blue Dog Democrat who was very, very popular, who probably would be the strongest candidate the Democrats would come up with to run in the seat that Saxby Chambliss is vacating. He also announced he's not going to run for the Senate. So Democrats don't have a candidate right now in Georgia. Republicans don't have a candidate right now in Iowa.
Although these would be two seats which would represent a keep for both of the two parties that seem to be favored at the moment. Harkin's seat, of course, a Democratic seat, and the Chambliss seat, a Republican seat. Also, it's interesting to note that among the Republican members of the House delegation, this does look attractive, and several of them I've already jumped into the race.
Right. Paul Brown, Jack Kingston, and Phil Gingrey, and even more Republicans may get in the race. It's interesting how some states' parties just cannot buy a candidate, and other states it seems to be no shortage of hopefuls. By the way, speaking of candidates up for the Senate in 2014, two of the perhaps more vulnerable candidates are Mark Begich in Alaska and Mark Pryor in Arkansas. Both of them have been targeted by Mayor Bloomberg's anti-gun campaign. Now, you know, it's one thing to criticize Jeff Flake, a Republican, and Kelly Ayotte, you know, a Republican, for voting against the background checks, and a lot of pro-gun control groups were anxiously going after them. But when Bloomberg also targeted Democrats, and he's targeting Begich, he's targeting Pryor, also Heidi Heitkamp, who's not up in 2014, then Harry Reid said, whoa, you can't do this. I mean, you can't go after Democrats because you'll hurt the chances of them winning.
From the standpoint of Harry Reid, it's one thing to go after Republicans and another to go after Democrats. Mike Bloomberg, it should be remembered, is neither a Republican nor a Democrat. He considers himself an independent, and whatever designs he has on further office in life after he leaves Gracie Mansion would be as an independent.
One thing to say before we go off is that something that ordinarily would have made big news this week but didn't, Delaware became the 11th state to now have same-sex marriage. Last week it was Rhode Island. This week it was Delaware. Just 1 year ago this week, this Thursday, President Obama went on the air and said, I've changed my mind. I've evolved. I am now in favor of same-sex marriage. It's pretty remarkable to me that Rhode Island and now Delaware now have same-sex marriage on the books. It's not a big headline. It's almost like a shrug of the shoulders. It's amazing how...
Doesn't make page one.
It's amazing how that's changed and shifted in 1 year.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Sharish Date.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Come on, baby, let's talk today. Come on, baby, let's play the game of life.